This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know what I love? I love when Ben Bernanke goes out of his way to make you feel better, like he did today, talking to Congress.
The position we've taken is, I would say, at a first cut, is do no harm.
Right? Come on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 17th of July. Good to have you with us. Today's congressional testimony from the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States was fairly unremarkable, to be honest with you, except for two things. One, members of the Senate Banking Committee seem to have taken a sudden interest in LIBOR. Many questions, Mr. Bernanke, about the manipulated interest rate that was in the news a couple of weeks ago. And two, a couple of members of the panel actually asked him what they should do to get the economy going again. He was not going to touch that.
I've been assigned to focus on maximum employment and price stability, not to hold threats over Congress's head. Congress is in charge here, not the Federal Reserve.
Boom. Anyway, something the Fed chairman didn't say today could be seen as good news if your future is tied to a 401k or a pension plan. Bernanke offered no hints the central bank is going to be buying more government bonds, as it has been for a couple of years now. That, in turn, sent Treasury yields just slightly higher. And every little bit helps when it comes to retirement investing these days, since interest rates are so low. Take, just as one example, the country's biggest pension fund, the California Public Employees Retirement System. In the fiscal year just ended, CalPERS managed to eke out, get this, a 1% return on its investments. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the story.
Given inflation, 1% is barely standing in place, but that hasn't changed the rosy outlook from CalPERS. It needs to reach 7.5% to afford retirement benefits for more than 1.3 million government workers in California. Chief Investment Officer Joseph Deere told us today he remains confident of meeting that obligation in the long term. He notes that just 2 years ago, the fund enjoyed a 20% return.
One of the genuine attributes of a market system is cycles. Sometimes things go really well and there's a lot of exuberance. Sometimes you're in tough periods and there's a lot of pessimism. And what you know is the cycle will turn and things will change.
Deere says as bleak as things look for the biggest of pension plans down to individual 401k investors, the same rule applies.
One of the keys to success is understanding what your risk tolerance is, developing an investment plan that you have a high degree of conviction in, and then sticking with that plan. You can be happy when it's performing well, but you can't abandon it when it begins to underperform.
But a growing chorus of critics argues state and local pension plans do need to change to recognize today's realities and risks. Andrew Biggs is a pension analyst for the American Enterprise Institute.
These guys are not running a 401k plan where if the returns aren't there, it's somebody else's problem. If the returns don't materialize, it's CalPERS' problem. It's the taxpayer's problem.
Biggs says rather than taking on more risk in the quest for elusive returns, the CalPERS numbers illustrate that government and employees will need to pay in more to make up the shortfall. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Two things about the new CEO of Yahoo today. One, it's Marissa Mayer, not Mayer. We called up her new employer and asked. And two, holy cow, does she have her hands full. Even with the 13 years of experience at the Internet's biggest search engine that she does have, is that enough to turn Yahoo around? Yes, Lee Iacocca saved Chrysler and Steve Jobs turned Apple into Apple, but that's a pretty small sample size, right? Marketplace's Sally Herships has more now on how much a CEO can really do.
Every month, 700 million people go to Yahoo.com, but Marissa Mayer is just one person. So can a single CEO turn around an entire company?
It is possible. It has been done. but they are newsworthy, which means they're rare.
Ed Sewell teaches leadership at Georgetown, and he's talking about famous CEO superhero stories where new leaders swooped in to save the day, or Ford, Starbucks, and IBM.
It usually is not within the abilities or capabilities of any one human being to turn around a company.
But when a new CEO steps in, it is an opportunity for a company to think about change, its structure, its culture, its people. That's according to Catherine Phillips. She teaches leadership at Columbia Business School.
How are we going to make money, right? What product are we providing and to who are we providing that product to?
Phillips says Yahoo is losing advertising dollars to rivals like Google and Facebook. Georgetown's Ed Sewell says making up lost ground in the tech world can be extra tough.
Because turnarounds take time. You know, the metabolism of a high-tech company and the high-tech industry is such that you don't have a lot of time.
Meyer is Yahoo's fifth CEO in 5 years. And what she needs now, Sewell says, is patience from the company's board members. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, green arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What do you suppose happens when a guy invents a board game that hits big, he sells it for enough to be comfortable, and then he wants to do something that matters? The story is told in a new book called Bright Lights, No City. Max Alexander wrote it. His brother Wit is the one with the board game. Cranium from 15 or so years ago was his idea. Guys, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Scott.
So, Wit, let's set it up. You are inspired by a speech that Bill Gates gives at Davos a couple of three, 4 years ago about creative capitalism, and you say to yourself, I'm going to go sell batteries in Ghana. How come?
Well, it goes back further than that. You know, really, you know, in my 20s, I lived and worked throughout West Africa. So really for decades, I've had this vision of there's got to be a way to profitably and sustainably deliver tools to build better lives. And I said to myself, if I don't do this now, when am I ever going to do it?
So, Max, talk to me about the battery part of this. I mean, batteries over there are, I mean, they're everywhere, right? Because nobody's on the grid.
That's right. About half the population is off the grid, but that's really most of the rural population. So as soon as you get out of the big cities, you find everybody's using batteries. And what Wit discovered was that they're mostly using these very inexpensive but poorly made carbon zinc batteries. And these are the kind of batteries that are like so cheap that they're not even sold in the West anymore. This is like Christmas 1958. These are the kind of batteries that leak. And so Wit saw an opportunity to bring in rechargeable batteries that would be cleaner, safer, work better, and would be less expensive for them to use.
Wit, give me a sense of the business model. Max just mentioned rechargeable batteries. So you go to market with this. The first one was what, a double A, right?
That's correct. We've got a double A rechargeable nickel metal hydride battery. Nothing magical about it. A commodity item. Probably our biggest innovation in that original service is a little D adapter that allows it to work as a bigger battery, which is what most people are using in Ghana. So, you know, that was kind of our flagship product, and we had to start somewhere. But right now, we're expanding the catalog beyond energy offerings. We've got our first solar product on the market. We've now got battery-powered lights as well. And we're really excited now to be introducing our first health product with some eyeglasses.
It's actually so interesting talking to Max the Word Guy about this thing and with the business guy with the boom, boom, boom facts and figures. And clearly your roles here were separate but conjoined somehow.
Yeah, I really, before this whole adventure in Ghana, we hadn't really spent a whole lot of time together, especially recently. But even growing up as kids, I almost want to say we probably had more kind of quality time together in Africa than we ever had back home.
Yeah, well, there's a part of this book that reads as sort of as an adult coming-of-age tale, right? You guys discovering each other and in the process working together to build this business.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, one thing Max didn't mention there, Kai, is, you know, Max taught me to read. You know, Max sat me on his bed and read me every Hardy's Boy book as as a kid. And, you know, for me, it was great to have him along, getting me more in tune with the narrative of what was happening day to day, beyond just that chop, chop figures and facts.
Right.
And, you know, here we go. What's the brand positioning?
Right. And there's no small part of that, actually, in this business model, right? I mean, it is, to quote you, actually, back to yourself, you're at this weird nexus of charity and for-profit.
That's exactly right. And, you know, charity is critical. You know, it's indispensable in disaster relief situations. But, you know, we're really committed to showing that there are ways on the ground that you can do better than free. You know, free can be counterproductive. And, you know, what we've learned in Ghana is people are ready to invest in building better lives. You know, we want to be there tomorrow and beyond, and free just can't do that.
The company that Whit Alexander runs in Ghana is called Burrow. The book by his brother Max about that company and their adventures over there is called Bright Lights, No City. It's a good one. You should read it. Guys, thanks a lot.
Our pleasure.
Thank you,
Kai.
Thank you. See you, Whit.
Bye, Maxie.
Pictures of Whit and Max Alexander in Ghana and an excerpt from the book are on our website. It's marketplace.org. If you're in California and you buy, say, a tent online from an out-of-state retailer, you don't pay sales tax. Handy for the consumers among us. States, though, say they're losing $23 billion a year in unpaid taxes on transactions like that. And government deficits being what they are, it's no surprise there's bipartisan support in Congress to make online retailers collect state and local sales taxes. The kicker here is that Amazon is one of the companies that's in favor of that. Marketplace's Queen Kim has more now on what could be a new chapter in e-commerce.
Once upon a time in e-commerce, like a decade ago, online retailers like Amazon said collecting state and local sales taxes could kill their young industry. It was one of their only competitive advantages over brick-and-mortar stores. Well, fast forward to 2012, and that argument, it's over.
I'm sorry, I don't buy it at all.
That's Steve Del Bianco, executive director of NetChoice, a trade group that represents e-commerce companies like eBay and Overstock.com.
There's no evidence that consumers actively use e-commerce because they want to avoid sales tax.
Many big e-tailers are already collecting taxes, and that hasn't hurt sales. Turns out, online shoppers are more affluent.
In order to be an Amazon customer, it starts with having internet connection, having a machine.
That's Gene Alvarez, an analyst at Gartner. By machine, he means a computer. And he also says you generally need a credit card or an office or somewhere where it's safe to leave packages. So e-commerce shoppers don't mind spending a couple of dollars on sales tax. What they do mind, waiting.
The competition is shifting from you won't pay tax to how quickly we can get a product into a consumer's hands.
To do that, big e-retailers need to be closer to their customers. Amazon has distribution centers in more than a dozen states. And in each of those states, it'll eventually have to start collecting sales tax. So now, their competitive edge depends on making sure all the other e-retailers collect taxes too. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Retail sales overall, of course, are down, and we've been asking you on Twitter what you're spending money on if you're not shopping. Sean Connell tweeted us, using it to offset the rise in grocery prices, mostly. You can tweet us at MarketplaceAPM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. All right, so if you've been following the presidential race the past couple of weeks, and by following, I mean paying even the slightest bit of attention, you've heard the sniping, each guy saying the other sent American work abroad, American jobs overseas, certain political death, if true, given the state of the economy. But it's not that easy, because beyond even the simple question of how many jobs are we actually talking about, there's more. We asked Todd Zwillick to find out.
President Obama accuses Mitt Romney of running companies that shipped about 800 jobs overseas. Mitt Romney says Barack Obama gave more than $1 billion in loan guarantees to a company that builds solar panels in Mexico. No independent fact checker has said either of these charges of outsourcing is true. But voters have to wonder, who's the worse outsourcer?
It's a ridiculous question in the first place.
That's Douglas Irwin, professor of economics at Dartmouth College.
neither of them is directly an outsourcer. President Obama doesn't run any business and hasn't shifted operations of that business from the U.S. to other countries. And Mitt Romney is working for Bain. They're merely advising companies about how to improve their operations and become more profitable.
So if neither of them has outsourced anything, here's another question. Which of the two parties backs policies that lead to outsourcing? The answer is both. Here's Dean Baker, a liberal economist and co-director of the Center for Economics and Policy Research in Washington.
There's certainly a consensus among the people who have been in the White House for the last two decades that's very much at odds with the views in the public as a whole.
Baker says corporations want the freedom to cut costs and sell products overseas, and that Washington delivered decades ago in the form of bipartisan trade deals like NAFTA. So if the candidates have you mad about outsourcing, which one should you choose? Douglas Irwin says it won't make a difference.
Because once again, there is this consensus in Washington that allowing the markets to work this way shouldn't be impeded, and no one is really going to do much about it.
Not unless voters decide that outsourcing is more than a dirty word, and it's actually bad policy. In Washington, I'm Todd Zwillick for Marketplace.
Coming up, three-pointers and layups and retirement airballs.
They have to manage their money as though they are 60-year-old men about to retire.
Forcing NBA millionaires to save for their golden years. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so the perils of trading while listening to Ben Bernanke were clear today. Markets fell as the Fed chairman started his report to Congress, but were up after he finished saying there was little new to say. The Dow Industrials jumped 78 points, about 0.6%, closed to 12,805. The NASDAQ up 13 points, nearly a half percent, 29.10. The number of the S&P 500 gained 10 points. That's 0.75%, closed at 1363. Somebody at Bank of America is looking forward to the opening of Cars Land. Walt Disney Company rose 3% today after B of A raised its stock to a buy based on the new theme park in this year's Avengers movie. I don't know. I saw it Saturday. Not that good. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of June. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary on current economic conditions. And the Senate Caucus on International Narcotics Control holds a hearing to discuss prescription drug abuse in the U.S. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The government releases economic data all the time, not just the biggies like unemployment, but all kinds of things, crop prices, gas prices, housing numbers, all of which are closely guarded secrets until the officially designated time. Business reporters typically get access early so they can write their stories, but they are actually locked in a room at the Labor Department until 8:30 or whatever the official time is. There's concern, though, that traders might be able to somehow get data in advance, which would be a bad thing, markets-wise. So the government is tightening up on its security. Scott Patterson is a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He is also the author of a book called Dark Pools. It's about high-speed trading, which is at the root of the government's worries here. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what happens? Run me through what happens if instead of at 8:30 in Washington, somebody gets these numbers at 8:29:30. What can they do?
Okay, so these firms have the ability to react so quickly to information that they can transmit that data into a buy or sell order on the stock market within fractions of a second.
These are trading firms doing this.
Yeah, these are what are known as high frequency traders. They could have the data at, you know, 8:29:59 and beat everybody else to the market. I've actually heard stories of firms that have put up microwave dishes next to government offices like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that microwave technology allows them to transmit data extremely fast across the country. So they may even be transmitting data to Chicago so they could trade on futures markets on this information.
All right. So, I mean, I get the whole high frequency trading and speed of trading thing, but what is what's worst case scenario? They get these numbers early and what?
Well, I think the worry is that they move before everybody else. They get to profit on the move ahead of time. And then when, you know, your average Joe trader comes into the market's already moved up.
Or down, right? I mean, it could be a sell order too.
Or it could be a sell order, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is illegal behavior, essentially. You're not supposed to be able to act on information ahead of others. It's supposed to be a level playing field.
Yeah, that's a very important point. It's a crime, basically.
Yeah, it is a crime. And if it's going on, then it should be stopped. The government has been looking into this and the FBI has looked into it. And, they haven't said that they've actually caught anybody leaking the information ahead of time. So I think that is the fear. But what is definitely happening is this information is put out in so-called machine-readable form.
Right.
These firms have artificial intelligence systems that can read that machine-readable data and react far quicker than any human being could. So they already have an advantage. And if they're getting the data quicker than anybody else, and that's, you know, that just makes it ridiculous.
Oh, good. Scott Patterson. He's a staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal. His book about all this kind of stuff, high-speed trading and all that, is called Dark Pools. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We have, in this country alone, something like 70,000 tons of high-level nuclear waste, 250,000 tons worldwide, give or take. What we don't have, here or anywhere else, is a place to put it all. And figuring out where to put it means you have to convince people it's going to be okay to store nuclear waste where they live. Corey Princell has that story.
What's more powerful than cesium-137, strontium-90, and plutonium-239 all put together? Nimbyism 101. I'm in Gorleben, Germany, descending down into the earth more than half a mile. Peter Ward is a geologist who works at the mine.
We're now standing at shaft number one, and this is the main shaft down the mine.
In the 1970s, the German government picked this site as the place where it would bury its nuclear waste forever. Like their counterparts in the U.S., they chose a sparsely populated area with what they thought was great geology for stuff that basically has to sit around for hundreds of thousands of years. 35 years later, they're still studying it.
We are exploring the salt dome to find out if it's suitable for the storage of radioactive waste.
Underneath Gorleben is a massive underground salt deposit called a salt dome. And when the elevator doors open, the ground under our feet and the tunnel walls arching over our heads are white. You can even feel fine particles of salt in the air. Ward says these conditions are perfect for storing nuclear waste. It's dry, geologically stable, and salt has interesting properties. If any fluid gets to it, it forms a watertight seal. And if it's disturbed, salt flows, surrounds, and entraps. Ward says a canister of nuclear waste would get safely locked away.
It'll be closed in like that, it'll be hermetically sealed. This is the idea behind salt.
And yet there's no nuclear waste here. 35 years later, the German government still hasn't approved the site. Protests are an almost daily event in Gorleben. Klaus Poland has lived in this area and fought nuclear waste since the beginning. He says the community never had any input into the site's selection. They're still mad, and they'll keep fighting it.
We don't trust nobody of our authorities. Never.
That sentiment is echoed from Gorleben to Nevada and around the world.
The only way to be successful is to have a volunteer site.
Back in the U.S., Frank Hansen studies nuclear waste storage at Sandia National Labs in Carlsbad, New Mexico.
That is the other half of what you need. You need the science and you need the community.
The situation in Germany is a lot like the situation here in the U.S., stalemated, until recently. Earlier this year, a presidential commission toured the country, and one place they visited was the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP. It's a low-level nuclear waste storage site, not far from Carlsbad. And that site may have those two things going for it. Geology, it's a big salt deposit, like in Germany, and local support. Bob Forrest is a former mayor who helped bring WIP to Carlsbad.
We had housewives for WIP. We educate the public. We've taken
everybody in the world through this facility.
And Forrest says what Carlsbad told the commission is that they want the high-level stuff.
Bring that stuff to WHIP and cut out the red tape. You know, if they want to save money and cut back and do the right thing, and the public wants it, God, there's not a better opportunity than to expand this project.
The Presidential Commission wasn't charged with selecting a new nuclear waste site, but one of its members is now heading up the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In fact, at her confirmation hearing, Allison McFarlane mentioned Carlsbad. We don't need to look as far as other countries for lessons on nuclear waste, she said, suggesting we have all the answers we need right here. I'm Corey Princell for Marketplace.
Corey's report is part of the public radio project Burn, an energy journal. It's from Sound Vision Productions and produced in association with this company, APM. Special thanks also to the National Science Foundation. Whether he stays in New York or winds up in Houston, Texas, Jeremy Lin is going to be a rich man. The Knicks have until tonight to match a three-year, $25 million offer from the Houston Rockets. And even though he's only 23, it's still not too early for him to start saving for retirement. In fact, the NBA is going to do some of the planning for him. Starting this coming season, players will be automatically enrolled in a retirement plan because having a lot of money doesn't make you good at managing it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
James the drive. Count it and one.
Players lucky enough to make it to the NBA can live large. Big houses, big cars, fistfuls of bling. The average salary is more than $5 million a year. But what happens when the cheering stops? A few lucky players land gigs as sports announcers, but many struggle financially. Ed Butowski of Chapwood Capital Investment Management advises a number of current and retired pros. He says the stats are stark. Apart from the very highest paid players,
over 90% will be bankrupt or in financial distress by the time they are 50 years old.
Bad real estate investments, businesses gone south, homes and cars repossessed. The stories are common. Butowski works to give clients a better ending. Athletic careers are short, so even though some players go pro as teens,
they have to manage their money as though they are 60-year-old men about to retire.
That doesn't come easily to guys under 30. Accountant Corrine Riley has a number of athlete clients.
They don't have the concepts of how you save for the future, how you manage your money, what are the things that you should do in steps, because it all comes up front.
Athletes aren't the only people who do stupid things with their money when they're young, but there's a key difference, as Merrill Lynch financial advisor and former NFL player Reggie Wilkes explains.
The money they make in their 20s must cover their living expenses for 40, 50, 60 years.
And saving for that may prove as tough as anything they face on game day. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one of those surveys that makes you say, wait, what? Come on. Something called the American Consumer Satisfaction Index says social media users prefer Google Plus to Facebook. Never mind the 900 million-something users that Facebook has. Seems Google Plus gets higher ratings because of its privacy policies, which does kind of all make sense. Thanks to Mary Dew, John Haas, Justin Ho, and Liza Madry on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.